It is with excitement that I get to share with you that the Leukemia Foundation has developed a new resource. This resource is called the Online Support Service, where it provides a wealth of services to assist a person living with blood cancer throughout their patient journey. So whether you're a patient who has just been diagnosed, in treatment or in survivorship, this service provides access to targeted learning modules, a suite of amazing services and online programs. And you also have the ability to chat with an experienced blood cancer support coordinator at just one click. It gives people a personalized and intuitive way to learn about important topics, including what to expect beyond treatment. This service is simple to use and is filled with content curated by the Leukemia Foundation for people with any type of blood cancer. It notably features a digital energy coach to help patients manage fatigue. So jump onto our website and look up our new and exciting product called the Online Blood Cancer Support Service. Hi, and welcome to the Leukemia Foundation's podcast, Talking Blood Cancer. My name is Kate Arkadiff, and my role at the Leukemia Foundation is a blood cancer support coordinator. We provide emotional and practical support to people living with blood cancer and their loved ones. Our support is offered throughout the many different stages of a blood cancer journey. While listening to this podcast, we will share the stories of people we have connected with who have faced blood cancer so that you, our listeners, can gain insight, find purpose, and take inspiration. The Leukemia Foundation acknowledges the traditional owners of the country throughout Australia and recognises their continuing connection to land, sea and community. We pay our respects to their elders, past, present and emerging. This story may contain content that some listeners may find difficult and challenging. We encourage anyone listening to take care of their own mental health and well-being. The purpose of this podcast is to share the real-life stories of people living with a blood cancer, and any discussion of medical treatments is not an endorsement. We encourage you to seek the advice from your treatment team if you have any questions regarding your diagnosis, side effects, or treatment. If you would like to talk to someone, or even if you would like more information on our services or on today's episode, please feel free to contact 1-800-620-420 and someone will be able to connect you with your local blood cancer support coordinator. In today's episode, I am speaking with remarkable Kirsty Everett. At the age of 9, Kirsty was diagnosed with ALL. After she completed the grueling treatment, she went on to live life to the fullest. And then, at the age of 16, she heard the news that she had relapsed. The battle was much harder this time, and the odds were against her. However, Kirsty looked this challenge in the eye once again and took it head on. Kirsty discussed with me what it was like dealing with blood cancer at such a young age. Not only has Kirsty gone on to beat blood cancer for the second time, but she has turned her diagnosis into her purpose. Recently, she became a published author with HarperCollins. They published her memoir, Honey Blood, which is such an insightful read. I really encourage you to have a listen to this episode and even maybe go out and buy yourself a copy. So let's get into today's episode. Welcome today, Kirsty. Thank you for being here.
That's okay. Thank you so much for having me. It's a privilege. Thank you so much.
What we usually do for the start of the episode, we ask the person we're interviewing just to tell the listeners a little bit about who they are, where they're from, who's in their family and when and what they were diagnosed with.
All right. So I was first diagnosed with acute lymphoblastic leukemia or ALL. When I was 9 years old, I had about 2.5 years of chemotherapy, had a really good, I think my survival chance was about 70%. everything went as well as it can go for having 2.5 years of chemo as a kid. Then I was in remission from about the ages of 12 to 16. And then when I was just about to start year 11 in high school, so I was 16, my cancer came back again. So I relapsed, about 4.5 years after being in remission. And my chances of survival the second time were pretty bad. I think it was only about 17% when it came back the second time. It was a lot harder to get rid of, and pretty much everyone thought that I was going to die. So one of the many reasons that I wrote my book Honey Blood was that I remember thinking as a 16-year-old, if I ever get through all this, I am going to write a book and somehow try to turn all of this yuckiness into something that can be helpful to other people, I guess. So, yeah.
And you are based where in Australia?
So I'm in Sydney, and more specifically, I am from the Sutherland Shire, born and bred. Please do not hold that against me. And I totally fit the stereotype too. Like, I have blonde hair, I have blue eyes, and I married a guy that I went to primary school with as well. So some of the stereotypes about the Shire are indeed true, but none of the bad ones apply to me. So please don't hold that against me.
Never will. Oh, well, thank you for that insight. I think, you know, we haven't had somebody on the podcast that was diagnosed at such a young age. So to be able to shed some light onto that area of childhood cancer is what we hope to do today, and to help give parents and listeners and even people that were diagnosed when they were young themselves and now a young adult some insight into how you've gotten through those experiences and how you're living today. So can you tell me, how did you feel after beating cancer the first time around? Because as you said, you were 9 years old, had a number of years, and then you relapsed at 16. Is that right?
Yeah. Well done. you keep up better than some of my friends. So after I sort of, you know, we got rid of it the first time, I was 12 years old and I was starting high school. So one of the things that I honestly was just so excited to be free of the hospital, and I was also really excited to start high school, because in primary school everybody knew me as, you know, like, oh, that's the girl with cancer, that's the girl that might die, that's the girl that we bully sometimes, that's the girl we call a freak. So I was, first of all, really excited, to be free of the hospital and to be starting high school. You know, my hair had grown back a bit, so, you know, I sort of didn't look like a sick person. And so when I was in remission for those 4 years before it came back again, I did that thing that we all know is true. Like, we all know that we're supposed to live life to the full and do as much as we can. And I can say with total, you know, sincerity that that's absolutely what I did between the ages of 12 and 16. Yeah. I could not get enough of just everything. So at school, I was a massive high achiever. I always tell people, like, I'm a nerd. Like, I am. Like, I was on the SRC at school. I did public speaking. I did debating. I did singing classes, acting classes, dancing. Wasn't so great at dancing, but had a crack at it anyway. I got really involved in the theatre. I fell in love with William Shakespeare and his works and performing them in the theatre. What else did I do? I went skydiving. I went swimming, like, with sharks. And, you know, your parents kind of, if, you know, when you have cancer as a little kid, sometimes they kind of let you get away with doing a few things that maybe. I remember mum being a little bit dodgy about the skydiving. I remember she was a bit. I remember she wasn't too happy, but I remember dad being like, it's cursed. She'll be fine. She's got this. Like, she's been through a lot. She'll be able to handle this one. So, yeah. So for those 4 years that I was in remission, I had so many friends. Like, I had friends at school. I had, you know, my theater friends, and life was absolutely brilliant. It was so full. I couldn't have packed more into it. I did acrobatics as well. So I've always been sort of a gymnast, acrobatic type person on and off when my body lets me. Yeah.
So was it almost like once you got that, okay, yes, you're in remission, off you go live life, that you, as you said, you really embraced it. And I think that so many people could relate to that as how they just jump back straight back into life, because you almost want to hold back onto what your old self, what pre-cancer took from you.
Yeah.
Would that be safe to say?
Yeah, absolutely. And so before I was diagnosed, my plan was I wanted to be a gymnast when I grew up. And, you know, if you're going to do that, you know, you have to do that young. And I felt once you're 12 years old, like that, if you want to be a gymnast, you know, it's over. Like if you're sort of not really into it by that age. So I did feel a little bit ripped off with that. But then, you know, you give yourself that mindset that, okay, maybe that wasn't the path that was supposed to play out for me. So that's why I thought, okay, well, if I can't do that, what else can I do? And that's, so I'm like, okay, well, and I was so amazed too that I, you know, myself and my siblings, we didn't go to fancy private school or anything. We just went to public school. And I remember thinking, this is so amazing that in a public school, there are all these amazing teachers who, you know, would teach like acting classes and teach debating and all of those things. And I thought, why wouldn't you just do all of this? Like, I remember not understanding why my peers were like maybe not into it as much as I was.
But and do you think that, you know, because you went, as you said, you touched on that you were bullied in primary school and things like that, and that a lot of the things that as a teenager you hold on to about standing out and about being different and about, you know, you want to be seen, but also you don't want to be seen when you're a child and teenager. Do you think that the life already threw that at you, where you were, you know, people, you were, you know, different because you had leukemia. Do you think that that helps you take away some of those pressures when you became a teenager? Go, you know what? No, I'm going to do it. I'm going to embrace it. And I don't care what others are doing. I'm not going to, you know, be a sheep. I'm going to stand out and do what I need to do.
Yeah, I think so. Like because I remember there being, you know, like it's so stereotypical, but sometimes stereotypes come from a place of truth. But I remember, you know, the more athletic, you know, jock type guys in my year at school sort of, you know, giving me a hard time, kind of being like, oh, you're like a debating nerd, or you're like the public speaking geek. And I remember thinking, I do not care. Like I was like, I don't care about that. The only thing that I did kind of get stuck with from the chemo was that it stunted my growth really badly. So I'm 144 centimeters tall, and I've been that height since I was 12. So I stopped sort of growing up. So in high school, I think everyone in year seven gets picked on about whatever is the most obvious feature. And I thought, well, yeah, I'm getting picked on because I'm short, which I don't really like. But, you know, I was never going to be a giant anyway. All of my family are little people. Like, we're not tall. But I remember just thinking it's just nice not to be, you know, the sick one, the cancer one, the bald one.
And how did you feel, you know, as you said, you went through that, you embraced life, you jumped on board, but how did you feel different after you relapsed compared to the first time? Was there...
When I relapsed, so like at first, I mean, when I relapsed, I knew it was coming months before, like, they actually kind of said yes. And I knew from my time in hospital, you know, the cancer patients that I knew as a kid, if they were on treatment because they'd relapsed, they usually didn't make it. And I knew that that's what, like, I was now, you know, one of the relapse patients that everyone was thinking, you're going to die. And
that statistic that no one wants to be.
And I always remember even my mum, like, saying things like, oh, you know, when you're in the hospital, you know, you spend a lot of time with, you know, people. And she was like, oh, that, you know, that poor boy, like, this is his second time, like, he's relapsed, and giving me that look like, well, we know what's going to happen to him. But, you know, I also had, you know, both times I was treated, I had oncologists that were both, you know, they never spoke down to me like I was a child, and they were very upfront about, you know, what my chances were and what was going on. And so when I relapsed at 16, there was this part of me that was like, are you kidding? Like, I've done everything right. I've been living life to the full. You know, I haven't been like a bad kid, like I haven't been running around drinking underage or like doing anything naughty. And I was like, this is, you know, this isn't fair. Like, this is like, I felt, you know, very angsty teenager, like, oh, I'm so ripped off. But it didn't last very long that I felt like that. I just kind of, I don't know what happened in my mind, and I, you know, even after writing a book, I still struggle to articulate. It wasn't a conscious decision, but somewhere in my subconscious mind, there was this kind of, well, you can all get stuffed because I know the odds are not in my favor, but I'm going to do this. I'm going to prove all of you wrong. I'm going to keep doing all of the things that I'm doing. I'm going to keep, you know, performing on stage. I'm going to keep, you know, competing, you know, at debating competitions. I'm going to keep coming to school as often as I can. Yeah, so I just, yeah, this mindset, I don't know if, you know, maybe it was like some sort of survival thing. It was just like, well, you know, anyone who thinks I'm not going to make it, which was pretty much everybody, it was always like, well, I'm going to show you, and I'm going to show you that you're wrong. And that kind of helped sort of, I don't know, put this sort of drive behind me. Yeah.
And from reading in your book, you did have quite a different journey second time around, because they were trying to find a transplant match for you, weren't they? Because your brothers weren't a match, and they decided, and they went to the register, didn't they? And that wasn't
an option. So, I mean, how ripped off is that? So I've got three siblings. I've got two brothers and a sister, and their bone marrow was completely useless to me. I mean, why else do you have siblings if you can't take their body parts or tissues from them? So I didn't have a match in the family, and, yeah, there was no one on the bone marrow registry. So my best chance at surviving was to have a transplant, but my oncologist didn't want to give me an unmatched donor. She said that what she would like to try was 3 years of chemo, which when you're 16 years old and someone says you're going to be on chemo for 3 years, especially after you've got into your head, oh, okay, I'm going to have a transplant, so maybe, you know, in less than 12 months, like, this will wrap itself up and I can get back on with things. So, yeah, the second time I was sick, yeah, had to have 3 years of chemo. And it, I mean, being on chemo is always bumpy, but I had a lot of really intense reactions, which, you know, often happens with the drugs. Like, you don't know how your body's going to respond. So there was a lot of trial and error and getting the right combination of things in my body so, you know, we could kill the cancer and hopefully not kill me in the process. So second time was very different. So, yeah, the first time very much felt like, it really did feel like, because, you know, I had the most common type of sort of childhood leukemia, it did feel like they were like, okay, here's the treatment plan and we're going to follow this. And, you know, sometimes it didn't go according to the plan. But, yeah, it did feel like, yes, we've done this before. But, yeah, the second time it was just like, yeah, it felt, you know, there were times where I felt a bit like a guinea pig, and there were times where I was like, oh my gosh, like, what are they going to do with me? Like, this isn't working. Like, what, you know, what's going to happen?
It almost sounds like the first time you're saying that you had, the team had such confidence in their plan and the process. And then the second time it was almost like, oh, you know, they weren't unsure because, as you said, you didn't have a match. And then, but it sounds like you really had to rally to back yourself and be like, nah, I've got this. I'm going to do it. It's going to be hard. It's going to be a big slog, but I'm going to beat this because, by God, I've got a lot to, it's a lot to live for.
Yeah. So, and as well too, like, the oncologist that I had the second time, Dr. Sue Russell, I mean, she's a genius. She's an incredible woman. And I mean, you know, the fact that I'm still here, I think is, you know, that's just proof that even though I was somebody, you know, my it was difficult to get rid of my cancer the second time, the fact that, you know, I'm still here and that she was able to figure it out. I mean, obviously she would have, you know, I'm hoping she had some brainstorming sessions. It wasn't just her alone in a room with a whiteboard. So I think she did an incredible job, you know, especially too, I mean, can you imagine their job, like dealing with a 16-year-old who is on chemo for the second time? And, you know, like teenagers can, they can tell when you're, you know, lying or not being 100% honest. And she was absolutely incredible with me.
Well, she sounded like she treated you like, you know, as a human, and it respected your body. And I think that that message in that you've said that, yeah, you didn't have a match, but you got through it. Because sometimes that's people's biggest fear is, oh my God, there's no match out there in the world. But to say you are living proof that it's a different slog and it's hard, but here you are. Didn't have a bone marrow transplant, went through chemotherapy, and here you are today, you know?
Yeah, I know. I actually turn in about, I think it's less than 2 weeks, I turn 40, and I honestly, I'm like, oh my gosh, like I never thought that I would live this long. Like this is incredible. And it really is, like, it sounds cheesy, but it is a miracle that I'm still here.
I celebrate that miracle.
I still scratch my head and go, oh wow, like all of that happened and I'm still going, like my body's still here, like
And so is there anything that you found helpful when it came through getting both of the treatments?
So in terms of, I mean, one of the things with being really sick is that you, even, you know, when you feel rubbish, like you have a lot of sort of downtime, I guess. And I was really lucky, you know, I had parents that from a really young age had instilled in me like a love of reading and appreciation of the written word. And so the first time that I was on chemo, I just remember reading so much, like, you know, just when I would be in hospital and I would just read and read and read. And I kind of feel sad for anyone who's on chemo who doesn't love to read, because it's like, you know, you've got a lot of time to pass and there's only so much Netflix you're going to be able to work your way through.
Yeah.
So, you know, having a love of reading was really helpful to me. The second time that I was sick, I guess I just accumulated more things that I loved. So, you know, I still performed in the theater. I still read a lot of books. I did my HSC while I was on chemo and while everyone was saying, oh gosh, you're not supposed to be here. Like we thought you were going to be dead 6 months ago. I think we're really lucky to live in a world where there's lots of creative people like musicians and artists, you know, writers, people like that. I feel they're like, they save people's lives, because when you're really sick, things like listening to music, or, I mean, I can't draw. The only thing I can draw is butterflies, but hell, I drew thousands of butterflies, you know, and when I was well enough, like I would get myself to the theater. I would watch theater. I would perform in it when I could. And just anything creative. Like we're so lucky that the world is actually overflowing. There's so many talented people that sort of never, you know, fully make it, and we don't hear from them. But I just, the second time I was sick, it was just like sort of, I kind of saturated myself with all creative things, all artistic things, and even things, like I said, like I wasn't great at drawing and didn't really know much about art, but started going to art galleries and started, you know, learning about artists and reading, you know, pretty much anything that I could get my hands on, just so my brain was alive and working and engaged, and most importantly, distracted, because I think sometimes one of the things that I don't know what anyone in what a psychologist would say about this, but for me, sometimes pretending that I wasn't sick was one of the most helpful things that I did. You know, if I was in the company of my friends and we'd be goofing around, listening to music, and in those times, I would forget that I was sick and I'd pretend that I wasn't sick. And yeah, it must have helped because I'm still here. So I think
so many people can relate to that, because it's just giving you that escape, isn't it? It's giving you that escape of what is going on in reality, and being creative can do that too also. And it's, you're right, it's about tapping into what you love and what makes and what lights you up.
Yeah.
And I think we're such in a lucky space in this day and age to be able to have the internet at our fingertips, and COVID has opened worlds up more than we ever thought. I know you can go to the art gallery in Paris, you know, virtually now, and things like that where we could never do that before. So definitely hear you say being creative and bringing in that light into your life is so important to help pass the tough times.
Yeah, and I think too, I mean, when you are like a child or a teenager on chemo, you get told, you know, a few times you get told, you know, if you want to drop out of school, if you don't want to worry about it, you can put it on hold. I'm really glad that I didn't do that. Like either of the times that I was sick, that I kept up with my schooling. I ended up doing extremely well, which surprised me. Like, because sometimes, you know, I'd be studying and be, you know, out of my mind on opiates and not even, so I don't even know how I was retaining information. Like,
and have a chemo brain.
So I'm really glad that I did that. I guess too, if, you know, if I was to drop out of school, I guess the only thing that, you know, then all you've got to focus on is the fact that, well, you're sick, like you're a sick person, and there's nowhere for you to be but the hospital or home. And I don't know.
Gave you purpose.
Yeah.
It gave you something to look forward for the future and to be, you know, excited about, even though there may be some teenagers listening going, oh, but it's schoolwork.
Yes.
It's your future though, isn't it? You know?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And so you, as you said before, you have such a love for the written word. And what made you decide to write a book?
I was actually speaking to someone recently and they were talking about being worried about their child, like during COVID and everything like that. I'm an English teacher, and I remember, like, I told them this quote, and it said something along the lines of, if you want intelligent children, give them books, and if you want more intelligent children, give them more books. And I really think, even though that sounds like a, you know, it doesn't sound like a very fancy, sophisticated sort of thing, I think the more you read, the more you open your mind, the more, I think people that read a lot are usually people that their sense of empathy continues to grow. It doesn't stop growing, which to me, I think that's magical. I think that's incredible. With my book, like I've written about things that actually happened, but these people who create whole worlds and whole characters and things like that for us to lose ourselves in, I'm like, it blows my mind how talented these people are. And I remember I actually first had the idea to write this book when I was really sick and when I was thinking, I'm probably the first idea that came when I was thinking about writing was I was going to write the book because I thought I was going to die and I wanted to write some stories for my friends and family. That's how the book started. And I was about 17 at the time. And I went and I did writing classes with Patty Miller. She's incredible. If you ever want to write your life story, she's your woman. But obviously I stayed alive, and so I thought I'll put the writing aside, and I went off to uni and did a couple of degrees and things like that. And then it was about 5 or 6 years ago now, there was this thing from the New South Wales Writers' Centre, and it said, oh, have you ever thought of writing a book? Like, send us 50 pages and, like, we'll help you out. And I sent something in that was, I'm so embarrassed now that anybody saw that, and I never expected to hear back from them. I don't think I even checked what I'd read, which is really unusual for me to not do that. And yeah, I heard back from them saying, you know, you've really got something here. And yeah, it just sort of made me go, okay, I always kind of wanted to maybe write a book, and there's so many swear words coming to mind right now that I'll keep for myself. I'm trying to look for the right word to describe cancer, but it is so brutal in so many ways, not just to the person who has it, but to, you know, their family and everybody connected to that person. It is so harsh. And writing the book, when I started sort of really focusing and putting my head down and doing it a few years ago, once again, I had this mindset of, I'm not going to let this thing just be this bad thing. I'm going to turn this into something that is good. I'm going to turn, yes, I have memories that are not pleasant, but I'm going to somehow make these good, and I'm going to somehow turn them into something that can help other people, that can make other people feel good. And I'm still surprised that HarperCollins thought I was good enough to publish. Like, I still pinch myself. I still ask them, are you sure you didn't publish me because, like, you pitied me, like, you feel sorry for me? And they obviously just think I'm mad, which is fine. Yes.
And having read the book myself, that it's and your message, as you've articulated, of being able to lose yourself in the word, that's what you've done for the reader and for someone to be able to relate, and then, as you said, grow their empathy for other people. And I think also to give parents an insight as to what it's like for a child to go through this and to grow up with this and experience, you know, cancer at school and with peers and even and how siblings' relationships and dynamics are also affected and impacted on a diagnosis. So your book beautifully did that, and I think HarperCollins, they were right in publishing that story. Do you think that you drew on it because you started writing because you, as you said, like, that was something that you really honed in on and was a survival mechanism for you when you went through treatment?
Yeah, I honestly don't know. Like, I wish I had something, you know, really sophisticated and profound to say to that. But it was just this simple idea of, there were certain things that happened when I was sick, and it was almost like the drive to write them down was bigger than me, I know I'm only short, so that's not hard. But there was this drive to write them down. It was like, these things need to be written down, but they need to be written down because there's things that people can take away from this that will be helpful, that will be good. And one of the things that I absolutely loved, I mean, the book's only been out for about 4 months, and, you know, obviously I'm not Delta Goodrum. I'm sure her book is doing far better than mine at the moment. But one of the things that I've loved about putting Honey Blood out is that I've heard from people who are now adults who, you know, they either had cancer as a child or as a teenager, and they're saying, thank you for telling the truth about what it's actually like to be sick. And I've had people thank me for being honest, and, you know, people have said thank you for not, there are, I won't name them, but there are, you know, a couple of novels out there that have been, you know, written that have, you know, characters in them with cancer, and they're so unrealistic, I think, like, I'm kind of glad that sometimes with the book, it's one of those things that you don't know if you've done a good job or not. And I have days where I think, have I done anything good? Has it helped anyone? And it's the days where you know, I hear from someone saying, oh, thank you for like writing this because that's exactly what it's like and you didn't romanticize it. You were really honest, but it also didn't, you know, the book, you know, even though it's got cancer in it, it's not going to leave you when you, like, if you read it, you're not going to read it and, you know, feel all depressed and, you know, miserable at the end because if I'd done it that way, then cancer would have won, wouldn't it? So
You took control.
Yes.
And it's almost you were writing out traumas and things that happened to you if you were taking control. And I think anybody can do that. Journaling is such a powerful tool to write out, you know, what you've experienced and what you've gone through to release that throughout, you know, to release it from your body. And I think that that's some in some respect of what you did with your book.
Cool.
So what was life like for you after you beat cancer for the second time? And, you know, what have you been up to since you were finally able to beat it?
So after we finally got rid of it the second time, my body was in pretty bad shape. Like it was,
I imagine.
It had taken quite a beating.
So 3 years of chemotherapy and then what, how many when you were nine? It was
about two and a half years. Yeah.
I'm very bad at maths, but that's almost like 5 years of intense chemotherapy.
And especially too, the second time they had to hit me like quite hard. One of the things that I had to have a lot of were lumbar punches, just in case anyone doesn't know what it is. That's when you have the chemo like injected like right into your lower spine. I had to have a lot of that done.
It's very common for children.
Protocol. And it's, you know what, it's a horrible procedure. And unfortunately it was one of the things that seemed to work for me. And so I had a lot of those. So had years of still being in pain from having all of those lumbar punches. And, you know, but even though my body wasn't in great shape, I went to uni. I had no idea, like I was just kind of like, oh my gosh, I'm still alive. So I think this might make me like quite a normal kind of teenager. I had no idea in terms of what career I would do. So in that sense, you know, the cancer didn't teach me what career to pick. You know, I did really well in my HSC and I could have done anything, but I actually chose to do a Bachelor of Arts at Sydney Uni. Everyone bags out arts degrees. It was one of the best things I ever did because I was able to study things that I was interested in, things that I was drawn to. I could kind of eliminate, you know, there were certain things I tried. Like I tried studying like linguistics and I went, oh, hang on, this isn't for me.
Yeah.
You know, so I got to figure out what I was good at, what I was most passionate about. And then after I finished that degree, I was accepted into the Masters in Teaching program that Sydney Uni had at the time. And so I did that and became a high school teacher. And yeah, I'm still a high school teacher. I teach mostly English, but I am qualified to teach drama and Aboriginal studies as well. But I've mostly taught English. And I am married to, oh my gosh, he mustn't be human, I swear to God. I'm married to an absolutely incredible man. His name is Ben, and we've known each other for a very long time. And he's seriously, like, I don't tell people that he's my husband. I call him my happily ever after man, because that's seriously what he is. He is, yeah, I couldn't have dreamed up, you know, I remember I used to read, you know, a fair few romance novels. Yeah. And I couldn't have dreamed up a better man for myself. So that's sort of what I've been doing, and then writing the book. And I have always, you know, anytime any sort of cancer organization has asked me to help in my capacity as like just speaking. I don't like, sometimes people have used the word like motivational speaker, which mm-hmm. I find really cheesy. It's so like, I'm more like being called, oh, she like tells cancer stories. She's like the storyteller of cancer stuff. So I've been doing that since I was about 14 years old, and I still do that to this day. I got an award from the governor about 15 years ago. Just, yeah, have never shut up talking about, you know, trying to get people just to be aware that cancer is out there, and everyone knows somebody who's had it or has lost someone, and, you know, people that go through it, like we need support and, you know, we need money. But, you know, if you're not going to get those things if people don't have knowledge and awareness. And I guess, you know, the English teacher in me sort of had that in mind when I was writing as well. It was like, let's kind of educate people. Let's give them, you know, let's show them what it's really like. And then, you know, it might help people understand a little bit better. And,
Because I think people also, forget, like, and you said you've gone through and you've dealt with pain post-treatment, that cancer still follows you even though, you know, in your words, you've beaten it. It's still there, and there's still follow-ups and there's still pain and side effects that you have to deal with, that people that are, you know, in their 20s, 30s, of our age, they don't have to deal with what you've had to tackle as well. So I think to be able to give a voice to that is really important and powerful. Because have you experienced, like, how you said your health post-treatment has, you've had issues and with your back and things like that, has that been challenging? Like,
yeah, it has been. It's I mean, there's people out there like who don't have cancer who have lived with chronic pain, and you have to be really careful because it can completely destroy you. It can bring you down, and you've got to be really careful that it doesn't do that to you. There's not. I've only had social media since my book came out. I've never had it, so if anyone wants to be my friend, that would be really cool. I recently put so I'm kind of like learning how that works and like watching what other people post up there. But recently, one of the things that I'm not sure, you know, sometimes my friends who haven't had cancer, what they're not aware of is, so recently, you know, a certain date passed, and that was the date when I was first diagnosed when I was a 9-year-old little kid. And every single year when that date rolls around, I remember, okay, it's been another year. Like, I have not had a single day where there's not been a reminder of the cancer stuff, or, you know, someone that I lost. My year is filled with significant dates of, you know, funerals, friends. You know, I lost a lot of friends, you know, both times that I was on treatment and in between treatment and after treatment. So, yeah, it's really hard. Like, it's almost, and it's a strange thing for things like loss to sort of always kind of be something that you're constantly sort of managing throughout your life. It's strange, and it can be very hard, and it is a tricky thing for people. That I spoke to someone this morning, and they said they'd only ever been to, they're the same age as me, and they said they've only ever been to one funeral. And I was like, what? And, you know, to me, I was like, oh my gosh, like, only one. I've been to, I stopped counting once it got over, I think I got up to like about 80 something, and I stopped counting them. And that was when I was 19 or 20. So, and the deaths haven't stopped. So,
And to being, as you say, other people in their 20s, they're not exposed to that, and they don't quite understand, as you say, the triggers that you hold on a daily basis and daily reminders of what is life post a childhood diagnosis, or, you know, an adolescent diagnosis of a blood cancer. And it and I think, as you've said, that it's, you've got those memories, and then to fill it with the joy and the take the control of, this isn't this isn't, I'm going to put this into a purpose that is for good, not to overtake and be overtaken to being in the shadow and the thing that brings me down.
Yeah. Yeah. And yet it's one of those things that, yeah, I do, I have to be, yeah, it's almost like if, you know, when you go on a diet, you've got to be really careful, like not to, you know, not to eat the Tim Tams. With me, like I do have to be really careful because, you know, there are constant reminders of, you know, friends that I lost and awful things that I saw. They're always going to pop up for me. So in terms of making sure that, you know, I acknowledge those things, I also have to make sure that, yeah, I'm in control of the way that those things make me feel. And it's almost like, I think this should be everybody's mission anyway, but it's almost like making sure that I stay happy. It's like this daily little mission. Like, what can I do to make sure that the fact that my childhood was very unconventional, what can I do to make sure that I, you know, it's present day, I'm alive, I'm well, there are so many wonderful things in my life. Let's be like, let's make sure we remember those things.
Absolutely.
Yes, you know, you're always going to be sad about some of the things that happened, but don't let them swallow me. Like, don't, I can't let them fully swallow me. I've got to be careful with that. Yeah.
No, absolutely. And I think that that's so important. And I remember listening somewhere where they said, you know, mental health is something that actually it needs to be practiced and filled and have attention daily. It's not something that we focus on when things get really bad and we bandage it up. It's actually something that needs daily work. And as you've said, you've got to treat yourself, you've got to look after yourself on the daily so that you don't fall into those slumps, or that when you do fall into them, because they're a natural, you know, that it does happen in life. We all go up and down a wave.
Totally.
But when you do hit that low point, that the bounce back is either quicker or softer for you. And I think that's the practice of supporting your mental health in a daily basis.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's a question I want to ask, and even though it is 2021, it is still quite taboo, and I think quite taboo in around, you know, the adolescent and you know, children with cancer and teenagers that have gone through cancer. But I want to ask you, and if you are comfortable, answer it. I'd love to hear your opinion. But did you think about death and dying when you were ill?
Yes. Yes, I did. I didn't talk about it with anybody, and it's not because there was nobody available to me for that. But yeah, I did think about it, and the strange thing was I wasn't, it never used to be sort of, oh my gosh, I'm scared I might die. It was more practical, like, oh, if I do die, like, I wonder how much it's going to hurt. And I also was, when I would think about it, I would be worried about my parents and my siblings, and it would more be like, if I die, are they going to be okay? What's going to happen to them? And even with my friends, like I was so lucky. Like the second time that I was sick in high school, I had some brilliant friends, and I got to immortalize some of them in the book, which was so cool. You know, I had these amazing friends, and I remember thinking, what is going to happen to them if I die? I wasn't there kind of going, you know, what's going to happen to me? Am I going to go to heaven? Am I going to go to hell? It was more like, oh gosh, it was more, my focus was on, gosh, like how is everybody else going to cope? Because, I mean, I could obviously see that me being sick, you know, it was a strain on people that were close to me. And I don't know if this makes sense, but I always kind of feel like that I'm kind of, it sounds so wrong, I'm glad that I was the sick one, because I think it would be so hard to watch somebody you love be really sick and be in pain and kind of just be on the sidelines. And I mean, I know you can be there for someone, and, you know, I had, you know, like I said, my my friends, my family, they were awesome, like cheerleaders. They were amazing distractions, and we got up to lots of mischief and silliness and things like that. But I always remember feeling really bad for them, thinking, oh my gosh, like they're watching this. Like with me, I'm like, it's all happening to me. Like it's all in my body and my body hurts. But I thought, gosh, it, you know, it wouldn't be nice to watch, you know, I wouldn't want to have watched one of my siblings be sick and suffer. And, you know, like I mentioned, like I got bullied and things like that. You know, if, you know, say one of my brothers had been sick and, you know, someone had called them a freak, I might have murdered them.
Yeah.
You know, so I don't know if that makes any sense. But
no, yeah. It absolutely does. And I think that I sit in front of people and hear, you know, carers speak about how, you know, that everybody's trying to hide their emotions and protect their emotions from one another because they go, oh, the patient, you know, the patient's going through this and it's so hard for them. And it's such an, it's so interesting for you to, you know, vocalize that you're actually doing the same thing, looking at the people that are caring for you and that are in your network. You're actually looking at them going, oh, wow, it must be so hard to be on the other side. And I think that's, it's beautiful to say, yeah, everybody's thinking the same.
Everyone's worried about everybody else, which, like, that's actually really beautiful. And like, I remember coming home from school, because when I'd be at school, like I would be in pain, like I would be sick and all sorts of things. But you know, I would smile and act like I was okay. And then I would get home sometimes and, you know, fall in a heap for, you know, half an hour because I'd been putting on this, hey, I'm okay. Like, don't worry about me. Like, look, I'm normal. Yeah. It's fine. You know, I remember my mother telling me, and to this day, like this breaks my heart every time I think about this. My mum told me that both times that I was sick, that, you know, my mum's one of those people, she, every day of her life, she has two showers a day, has a shower in the morning and she has a shower before bed. And she told me that she would always cry every morning and every night. And she did it in the shower because if you cry when you're in the shower, you can kind of like conceal it, like you can hide it from people. And I'm like, oh my gosh. Like, and I remember the first time she told me, I was devastated. I was like, why didn't you tell me? Why didn't you, you know? And she said, well, she said we were just, you know, like she told me that her and my dad, my dad's actually not alive anymore. And she said her and my dad, they actually sat down like when I first got sick and they said, okay, this is bad. This is not great. But we are going to keep moving forward and we're going to keep living life. Yes, you know, I was really sick, but you know, my brothers, my sister, like, I think they maybe got 1 or 2 days off school in the 5.5 years that I was on chemo. Mm-hmm. Like they didn't get any free passes or they didn't stop doing the things that they were doing because I was sick. And I actually think that was really incredible that my parents, that was their, what, that they got together as a couple and said, okay, it's just like, you know, in Finding Nemo, that whole like just keep swimming, like, you know, that mentality of just keep going, just keep, you know, even when it's really, really hard, even when it's like, oh gosh, we have to get through the next 5 minutes or the next hour, but just keep going forward. And perhaps that's why I was able to have that momentum for myself, was that behind the scenes, you know, my family, we were all sort of trying to do that together, but all sort of doing like secretly, like sort of on our own little secret missions of let's just keep moving forward. And
And I think, yeah, you're right. It sounds like your parents, they made that pact to go, we're just going to keep this as normal as we possibly can in an unnormal situation.
Yes,
And it's such a very common thing that I hear parents doing. And I think, you know, being able to create that space of, or depending on age, of course, of the child or of the adolescent, but to have those conversations too, to be open and honest about how we are all feeling, because as you've said and you've articulated, everyone is feeling those, or worrying about dying, or worrying about what ifs could be there. And Yeah, it is. Even in 2021, us as a in an Australian society, we're not very good at talking about death. And I think that it's important to know that just because you talk about it doesn't mean it's going to happen.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It's anyone that's ever, you know, had a cancer diagnosis, like cancer and death, they're kind of like two things that hold hands, you know, like if you get cancer at some point, it's going to cross your mind and the mind of those close to you that, hey, like this might happen. And yeah, some people will handle it better than others and be able to articulate their feelings really well. Like, and you know, I remember having one of my friends in the book, she had this amazing like sense of humor, but a really sort of dark sense of humor. And I remember one day she said to me, she goes, "You know, you're not allowed to bloody die. You know, you're not allowed." Like, I remember her just saying that to me, and we're just laughing. And and that was her way. And obviously she was awesome. But then, you know, you have other people where it's just too hard for them. And I remember my parents saying that people would cross the street to avoid having to see my parents or talk to them when I was sick, because they thought, oh, we'll have to ask, you know, about, they'd have to get asked about me. And I remember feeling really bad for my parents, like that people, it was just too much for them. It was too hard. And that's because of the whole cancer, like death thing. Yeah. Like it just, there's some people that, you know, fear does not, doesn't always bring out the best in people. So.
And that's the thing. I've heard that it's better to say something than nothing at all, because for the person that you're speaking to, or the person you're fearful of, the worst has already happened. Their loved one is being diagnosed. A catastrophic event has already happened in their life, and their path has been changed. So there's nothing that you could particularly, you know, say that's going to be worse than that. So even just saying how are you, or the simple of, you know, gosh, you know, I'm sorry, is sometimes, all that needs to be said.
Yeah. And I remember, like, awesome people as well, like, sometimes saying, what do you need me to do today? Do you want to talk about what you're thinking and feeling, or do you want to be distracted today? Like, and, yeah.
What
and
a I would great say, question.
I'd be like, yeah, let's talk about boys. Let's talk about who we've got a crush on today. Like, you know, and then other times I would be like, no, like, my body really hurts and I kind of can't see out of my right eye and I don't know why. Sometimes when people are not sure how to be supportive, it's okay to ask someone what they need. And sometimes, you know, there's been times where people have said, what do you need? And I'm like, oh, look, I really don't know right now. And then they've just taken the lead for me because, you know, I haven't been able to do it for myself. And I think, everyone just kind of does their best and,
Absolutely. So what's your health like these days? How is it?
It's pretty all right for someone who's about to turn 40, I reckon. My body can't make a baby. I don't have a uterus. Fertility's it is often an issue for the guys and the girls when we grow up. I remember talking to he would love me to name him, but I'm not going to. but I remember talking to a friend of mine and he actually said that he'd just been diagnosed and he was, I think, 17. And, yeah, they asked him if he wanted to, you know, freeze some to go off in a room with a little cup. And he just said no, because he said, I was a 17-year-old. He's like, 17-year-old guys are not thinking, oh, wow, I might want to have a baby one day. And
more worried about everyone's going to know what I'm doing in that room.
That's a whole podcast for another time, is the things that go on adolescent wards in the kids' hospital. My goodness. But yeah, a lot of, yeah, like I, there's another survivor that I know, and yeah, she's facing like fertility issues and things like that. And yeah, people, you know, who haven't had to be part of the cancer kind of world, they don't realize that it will be a problem for you when you're older. Yeah, as much as, you know, my body, I can't make a baby physically, that doesn't mean that I'm never going to be a parent. But it is something that a lot of people aren't aware of. Yeah.
They don't know how to talk about.
Yeah, it's a bit sensitive too. You know, I think, yeah, just, you know, people and making babies in general. I think society's a bit funny sometimes, the way that we talk about these things. Like when a couple gets married, you know, within a few months they're asked, oh, so you're having kids? And you think, well, hang on, just hold up a second there. Because, you know, even if they've had cancer or haven't had cancer, you know, sometimes
there's lots
these
of
things,
factors.
Yeah, there's lots of people who it's really hard for them to conceive, and, you know, there's losses and things like that are really hard.
Yeah, it is. And I think that, and especially for the females as well, that there isn't sometimes a lot of opportunity to look at egg preservation or to look at things that then can preserve their fertility down the track. I know definitely, you know, years ago there wasn't options like that, but there are options now that do help preserve eggs, but still the side effects that then you have to go through, and as to how life can lead down the track, it is a subject that people really struggle with, I think, also physically and mentally as well, to have to say I can't bear a child. People don't know how to touch and support that subject.
I'll just give a little shout out. I don't know if people will, actually I shouldn't say if, I did acting classes with Tahina Tozzi when I was growing up, and she's actually made a documentary, and I think it's called The Misunderstandings of Miscarriage as well. I only saw it recently, and I was like, wow, like there's conversations about these things that, yeah, they're not sort of happening. And I was really proud that she did that, because in my mind, you know, I always remember her as this perfect model, and, you know, she's totally gorgeous. And, you know, I never would have thought that, that she would struggle with anything. Like, she's beautiful. Mm. Doesn't that mean that her life is perfect? Like,
perfect.
Like, how awful is that, that I just made that assumption? Or she's a beautiful person aesthetically, so therefore everything's wonderful. Yeah, but, she did a really incredible documentary, I think, that's on Stan. And, it's sort of, she brought up a lot of those things, and, I was like, oh my gosh, like I wish I'd got a chance to talk to her, because yeah, there's lots of cancer survivors who have fertility issues, and we don't get a chance to talk about it. And it's kind of I remember actually being excited when I crossed paths with another female who she offered up a little fragment, and I went, oh, hang on, she's had some of the same problems as me. And I was so relieved. I was like, oh, I'm not alone. Like, okay.
Yeah.
Like it's, yeah. So, yeah, cancer certainly has a lasting impact. But you can certainly, like I've done with my book, you can take charge of what that lasting impact is going to be, and whether it's going to be one that's dark or whether it's going to be one that's got a bit of shine to it. And
yeah, absolutely. And I think that you perfectly just summed up almost my next question. And my next question was, is that, you know, what's kind of your main message, and what did cancer teach you? And are there any kind of golden nuggets you would want to impart on somebody that's gone through, or caring for somebody that's had cancer?
I think that was more than one question. okay, hang on. I'll start with the first bit that I heard you say. So I I was so lucky. When the book first got released, because I'm not a famous person or anything. And they said to me, you know, do you know anybody famous who could maybe interview you? And the only person that I could think of that I'd met lots of famous people doing charity work, but there was someone that I'd crossed paths with who I thought would be available. And so I asked if there's a playwright called Lachlan Philpott, and he's this incredible playwright, and he interviewed me, and he actually pointed out to me, so I didn't figure this out for myself, so I just want to give him the credit for that.
Yeah.
He actually said to me that he felt that the main message of pretty much my entire book was that we all need to kind of keep check on our level of empathy as we interact with people in, you know, every aspect of our lives. So in terms of the book having a main theme, as soon as he said it, I went, oh, wow, did I do that? And I'm like, I didn't plan that, but if that's – and then since then I've sort of looked back over at the book and gone, oh, wow, yeah, that is what's in there. And, and I think especially now, like with, gosh, everything that's gone on with the world and COVID and everything, I think empathy is more important now than ever. Like when you interact with someone, you have no idea what is going on for them. Like you may be interacting with them on the day that they are about to break. Need to be careful what comes out of your mouth and the way that it comes out and the way that you treat other people, the footprint that you leave, like, you know, like at the end of the day, like what footprint have you left? You know, if you've interacted with anybody, what have you left behind in the interactions that you've had with people? And, you know, do you need to check in with that and maybe just tweak it a little bit, maybe be a little bit more mindful of others? You know, I've often thought, I wonder what would happen if everybody just a little bit just turned up like the volume on the empathy that they already have. I wonder what would happen if the whole world made an agreement all at once to go, okay, we're all going to, like, for the next week, everyone, let's just try and have a little bit more empathy. I've always thought that would be a really cool experiment, but I don't quite know how to organize that one.
You work on that, but I totally agree, like, to connect. And I agree because to connect with somebody or to anybody that cares about you as a person, as your whole person, truly just really does make a world of difference, you know, to you. And you're right. If we all had empathy for one another, for what other ones were going through, experiencing, and how that would change your approach to life and the life of that person that you're exchanging, you're in exchange with.
And I think one of the other things you asked about is, you know, advice to anybody that's currently on chemo or is caring for someone on chemo. I am so sorry that I don't have a magic wand for you. I would like to go ta-da and like pull one out right now for all of you. But the only, like, I think that anybody who's in those situations, I actually have every confidence that right now they don't need my advice. I think that they're probably doing the best that they can. And you know what? Whatever your best is for today, like, that is good enough. You know, if today is a day where you've got to get on top of your pain management and you've got to take the nasty hardcore drugs that make you feel funny, then look, that's what's got to take place today. If you got to have chemo today and then, you know, end up puking later on, you know, you just have to do your best to get through it. And for those that are caring for people that are sick, I think your role is so, so important. And like I said, I don't have advice because I think anyone who is really sick or caring for someone who is really sick with cancer, I think they're already doing their best and they just need to keep doing it. That's all you have to do is just keep doing what you're doing. Yeah, and it's okay. Like, it seems bloody awful at the time. And, but you're doing it. You're doing it right now. Like, you're getting through it. So, yeah, that's my advice.
Well, thank you. And I truly appreciate you offering up your time today and you sharing your story and sharing your wisdom, because it's an insight that not many people have and that not many people are exposed to. So for you to sit here today and shed that light, I am truly thankful. So I couldn't thank you enough.
Oh, that's all right. Thank you. And I'm so glad to connect with the Leukemia Foundation and the work that you guys do. Yeah, keep it up, please.
Thank you. Thank
There's
you.
Lots of people that need you guys. So keep up the good work.
Yeah, and we will also put in the show notes a link to Kirsty's book as to where you can purchase it. But Honey Blood is out now, so please go and purchase.
Well, that brings us to the end of this episode today with Kirsty Everett. Kirsty, I cannot thank you enough for sharing your story with us here today and being so open and honest with your experience. It is such a unique story and just full of inspiration. Kirsty is one determined woman and one that will continue to be a voice for people living with blood cancer. If you are interested in reading more about Kirsty's story, don't forget you can read her memoir, Honey Blood. It can be found at your local QBD store or can be ordered from Booktopia. If you would like any more information on our service or on today's episode, please feel free to call 1-800-620-420 and someone will connect you with your local blood cancer support coordinator. Thank you for tuning in today. I'm Kate Arkadiff, and you've been listening to the Leukemia Foundation's podcast, Talking Blood Cancer.